Welcome, welcome. You're listening to our podcast, Two Massage Therapists and a Microphone. My name is Mark. I'm a registered massage therapist, registered kinesiologist here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. My voice is still not fully back, but at least I'm back doing the intro. Woo-hoo. Sorry.
You're looking at me.
Sucka.
Says,
no, I'm just
kidding.
You
know, I was a bit of a big baby about it, and I actually decidedly sat
down
today.
I don't know why you're a big baby
and
about
decided
it.
I'm not going to be a baby if Mark tells me to do the intro today. But I don't know. I didn't think that I was as resistant to change as maybe you or like our children. Are, but it just felt wrong.
Don't let me in with those two little
they
humans.
Take after dad. They don't like change. And I thought that I was a little more open-minded. And well, I thought I did, but but anyway, I was gonna not be a big baby if you made me do it today, and you're back doing it anyway. But so I'm gonna go back to my regular. Hey everyone, it's Amanda, and we have Jamie, who is a former LMT in Oregon, and her and I have been going back and forth through email for quite some time now, because she has what I just termed as a wildly specific job, doing treatment room design. So we're going to talk about how the heck one gets into that. And yeah, we'll see where the conversation takes us. So Jamie, welcome. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really appreciate you all having me.
Well, let's start very basic with some introductions. So who you are, like, tell us about how you got into massage therapy in the first place, when that period of your life was, and ultimately why you got out of it and started doing design for massage therapists instead.
Yeah, well, I'm old, so that's kind of a long story, but
hey,
I got
I'm
time.
Old too.
So I went to college in 1995. And I studied cultural anthropology, which was really academic and too academic for me, frankly. I ended up having an outdoor, like a summer of outdoor adventure that was for credit, that kind of reawakened my kind of inner knowing that I'm like a kinesthetic learner. I had been a dancer my whole life, a ballet dancer. As soon as I graduated college, went straight into massage school.
Are you going to ask the same question I am?
Why cultural anthropology?
Yes. Like what? Yeah. What drew you to that in the first place?
I have a friend. He was in my brother's grade, and my brother is 3.5 years older than me. His name is Mark. And Mark, when he finished high school, went to U of T for anthropology. And we used to be like, you think you're Indiana Jones? Kind of thing. Mark ended up, when he finished his university degree, he went on a couple digs up north in Africa and stuff. And then he went to massage school. And then after massage school, he went to chiropractic college. And he's still now a massage therapist and chiropractor.
I know, Mark.
Why cultural? And I probably butchered what anthropology is all about anyway, but why cultural anthropology?
You know, I don't remember why I made that decision, although, you know, I certainly, you know, was interested in sort of cross-cultural perspectives and ideas about how groups of people come to believe certain things. I was deeply involved in the rave scene for a long time. And, you know, that in California and the Bay Area and LA, and we had some pretty serious kind of conceptual ideas about what that meant to be in this underground culture. It was underground then. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to explore kind of those ideas about like how these groups of people that were subcultural created meaning together in some pretty specific ways. So I kind of explored that, but you know, didn't quite find my way in like the academic landscape. I also hosted a radio show and was a DJ throughout college and didn't quite see a future in that exactly either. And again, because I'd been a dancer for my whole life, I was like, great, I'll go do this thing that's body focused. That's kind of my innate intelligence. Mm-hmm. And did that, did my initial training in Santa Cruz. I have reflected on the fact that my first 50 hours of training were in polarity therapy. It sort of gave me this, I think, perhaps unique approach to body work that was a little bit more I don't know, a little bit more sensitive or something from the beginning, because I went on to do my 1,000-hour training in sports massage. So I kind of like eventually got this full spectrum of training that was both energetic and structural and kind of everything in between. Mm-hmm. So I really liked that integrative kind of approach.
This seems very parallel with your life. So far, I've learned you were a raving ballerina who's also a DJ on the weekends.
I want to know about the college, DJ stuff. Like when you say DJ at a radio station, you're spinning records, right? I'm assuming.
Yeah, I did a combination of vinyl and CDs.
Okay, so are most of the people that do that at college radio stations, I'm assuming this is a college radio station, are they in broadcasting? Or is it just someone that just kind of takes an interest in music and is maybe thinking about the idea of like, hey, I think I can do this kind of gig and I don't have any formal training in it. I don't really care to have any formal training in it. But how does that work? I'm curious.
Yeah, I was not in broadcasting, although I did sort of this like not minor in college, but a series of electronic music production. So if I had gone actually to SF State, I was going to be in broadcasting and TV production and film production. So I ended up kind of choosing a college based on the location more than the programming. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I knew I wanted to do something in radio or TV or film or something. So I just explored it. But I don't know. I don't even know that we had a broadcasting department.
People that do stuff in broadcasting, like, I don't know. It fascinates me. Like, I have a buddy, Sam. And ever since he was in high school, because we had a very specialized broadcasting class or whatever it was, media arts, I think it was called, something like that. And he was way into that. And then straight from there, he went to college for broadcasting. And he's been working at major networks and he's like a high up in major for a while. And it's just like a really interesting life that guy leads.
I find everybody's life interesting. Like I said, I'm now learning this person that I've been going back and forth with emails for months. Like I said, I've now learning is a raving ballerina that was a DJ and learned cultural anthropology, which, by the way, I can see how that would have been appealing. Although it is very academic, yeah. That would have been something that would have been really just fascinating to me, because that is something that... There's just, I don't know, there's so many things you can learn and there's so many ways that you can attach meaning to things and yep. What you're, I can see why that would be appealing to somebody. But then
that translates really well into healthcare stuff.
Yeah. And then going from that into massage therapy, what I'm thinking is, what did the people around you, people in your life, friends, family, whatever, were they like, Jamie, what the hell? Like, what are you doing? Or did they think this makes sense for you?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure anybody thought anything about what I was doing, other than my mom, who put me through massage school and was the beneficiary of all my practice hours.
So mom was cool with it.
She was totally cool with it. And it was really healing for our relationship. She ended up dying when I was like 25. So it was a really beautiful, like, few years of us getting to connect on a deeper level. It's funny you asked how I chose cultural anthropology as a major, and it was this is such a tangent, but I was at a rave with a friend, and we were saying, you know, if we're going to be good witches, we're going to need tarot decks. And then this guy came up to us with a backpack full of tarot decks, just, you know, sure,
of course,
coincidence.
Of course, yeah.
Magic happens. And I pulled out a deck, and each suit was represented by a different culture. And I had, in fact, just that week declared my major as cultural anthropology. So that was like a good little sign for me, a little omen, if you will. Mm. I don't know if that answered your question or not, but I think, you know, I think people really appreciated that I was doing massage therapy. I certainly got a lot of compliments on my work and a lot of positive feedback, and that felt good for me.
So what was your exposure to massage therapy before getting into massage therapy?
I had received massage primarily, you know, as a dancer and kind of more PT style body work, you know, not necessarily relaxing or therapy, you know.
Like dance injury rehabilitation type of thing.
So what about, you said you started out like learning more like energy type techniques. Was that on purpose? Like, did you intend to do that, or was that just part of the curriculum?
It was just the setup of the program that I was a part of. And I ended up being, I think, really grateful for that. And I even chat with other LMTs about now how sometimes, you know, there can be kind of a lack of nuance or subtlety in the touch that some practitioners have or don't have. And so I felt like it gave me that ability to, you know, sense energy from the beginning rather than learning it over time.
What are your thoughts on people who think that energy and talking about feeling energy or reading energy, what are your thoughts on people who think that it's, for lack of a better term, like woo-woo or, you know, nonsense?
I think it depends on the context. You know, I mean, I never promoted myself as an energy worker. I just appreciated having that skill set. Mm-hmm. So for people who don't believe in it, I mean, I guess within the context of my practice, I didn't talk about it or promote it necessarily. I just used it as part of my skill set. But more generally speaking, I don't know. If people are not into it, then, you know, there's a million other things.
So how long were you in massage therapy for? Because now you're out. Well, sort of out, but kind of out, you know.
Yeah. So I practiced full time until 2014. So that was like, what, 15 years. And then I injured my shoulder, which got eventually diagnosed as a like supraspinatus sprain strain or something very like anticlimactic for how much pain I was in. And so I continued to work part-time and then eventually dropped my license in 2018. During those 4 years, I also got roped into a multi-level marketing company.
Your face is telling me that this was not a super positive experience.
No, I think they're probably not really positive for most people. So, you know, after coming out of that experience, I took a couple years to kind of regroup. I was homeschooling my kid. I went to astrology school. I just kind of did some self-care, and eventually, at the beginning of the pandemic, maybe like a lot of other people, decided to make a more kind of intentional career pivot.
Sad moments, having to hang up the hands because of injury.
Yeah. I mean, certainly now as a newer designer, I've been doing it a couple years now, but you know, I'm still green. I would admit, you know, I was really great at massage therapy, and it's nice to be proficient in something, you know? So I do still sometimes, pine for those days a little bit. But you know, now sort of getting to work with the community still and feel like I'm still connected to the massage therapy community feels really good. And, you know, certainly it like makes my work really specific because I have that background and that insight.
Absolutely.
I do other kinds of interior design projects, but you know, when you're marketing yourself, you kind of have to pick a lane and have a niche market. So
yeah. Americans.
I want to ask Amanda.
I heard the word niche. I'm sorry.
Do we say niche?
Yeah, we're Canadian.
I can say niche. That's cool.
If you were forced out of massage therapy due to injury, like you leaving massage therapy willingly, like how I just kind of was like, I need to put this on the back burner for a little bit and go inactive. So I was happy for that. If you were forced out of it due to injury, would you be sad about it?
Of course I would. One, I'm injured. That's sad.
I mean, enough that your practice would have to, you know, pause big time.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I practice so part-time right now. But the thing is, why have I held on to this very part-time practice? I literally treat enough to keep my license. It's not, you know, it's not my full-time job, but I've held on to it because I don't want to let it go. I mean, I could. You tell me all the time I should let it go and just help you more.
How much is massage therapy part of your identity, and how much was part of your identity when you're practicing hardcore?
I'll let Jamie go first.
I definitely considered myself, you know, full-time practitioner, although I did at one point, you know, before I had my son, he's 11 now. I was trying to think of different ways to, you know, diversify my streams of income. So I developed my own line of massage and body care oils. And that was really fun, but I sucked at selling them. It also made me a ripe candidate to get, you know, recruited for an MLM that sold essential oils. Guess which one? And I also added on a health coaching certification, but I also found that really challenging to market. I felt like it was almost not entirely different, obviously, under the umbrella of health and wellness, but it felt like a much more active, engaged kind of client rather than somebody who is seeking, you know, rest, relaxation, restoration, recovery. So it was challenging for me to integrate that into my practice. And I think I was only kind of half-hearted about it, to be honest, even though, you know, I was passionate about nutrition and wellness and so forth.
Your turn.
Massage therapy, before having kids, I would have said being a massage therapist was a large part of my identity. And there's a reason I'm using having kids as like the marker of when that changed. But before having kids, I was treating, you know, about 26 to 32 hours a week. Okay. So, you know, I was very full time seeing patients. I was really involved in like wanting to learn everything. I really like was into like the health and wellness culture itself. Like I was a patient of every type of practitioner. I was referring to all these practitioners. I was networking. Like I was really, really immersed in it. And even, I mean, you would remember this. You and I would go out on a Friday night, and I think we've even talked about this on an episode. Yeah. We'd be walking home from the bar drunk, and I would be analyzing people's gaits. I'm like, look at that guy. What do you think's wrong? Like, it was so much part of my identity. I liked telling people that I was a registered massage therapist. Right. To me, that was like, I was proud of that title. Not that I'm not proud of that title now, but that was like, it really was part of my identity. I'm Amanda the RMT, and this is what I do, and I love it, and I live it, and I breathe it, and everything in my life is massage.
Sometimes I get so jealous when I see the dude that's got the job, and they like their job, they love their job, but it's just their job. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't make up a major part of their life. It's just like, this is the thing that I do to support my life. This is the thing that I do to create my life. It's not, when I see that, I get jealous. I really do.
So are you saying that your job is such a huge part of your identity?
It feels that way.
Well, interestingly, even though like back then when I was, I'm going to use the word just, but I don't mean it that way, just a RMT, like doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And now, after having children, I, you know, work with you running a continuing education company for manual therapists. I'm one of the organizers of the Canadian Massage Therapist. I'm one of the owners of Massage Therapy Media. I co-host a freaking massage therapy podcast. But now it feels like way less of a part of my identity.
Really?
And that line of having children is when just my priorities changed from like, to me, this is my job. This is how I support myself. And we've created a career where we can enjoy being at work and we can network with cool people. And I do really love what I do, but it is no way my identity. Mm. Like when I leave, I mean, you know this, when I leave work, I really want to be like not talking about work. I want to talk about other things. My conversation in the treatment room just now with my hairstylist, we weren't talking about hair, we weren't talking about massage. Her and I were talking about life. We were talking about hopes and dreams and our kids and all the, you know, what we want to do on summer vacation.
Oh,
like,
man. I'm jealous because sometimes I feel like I'm on such a fucking mission, and sometimes I don't even know what the mission is anymore, but I feel like I'm always on this fucking mission, and therefore it's always in the top part of the brain. You know what I mean? It's just sitting there constantly, and therefore it just drives me to just keep doing stuff and doing stuff and doing stuff. And then like today, I kind of fucked the dog a little bit, and I went and got a haircut, roamed around a mall. And then I went to a restaurant in the mall, and I'm sitting there having a drink, and I'm looking around at all the people just sitting around having a drink in the middle of the day. And I'm like, I bet you their job is not the top of their mind. And I'm kind of jealous right now. Yeah, it's kind of weird. Anyway.
Well, you're in control. You're in control of the mission.
Yeah. But I want to hear about your mission. I want to hear about what you're doing now.
Yeah. Like, I have to understand. I want to know
how this comes to be.
So we've gone from, wait. I'm going to make the train. We've gone from El Arena
like
to Raver to cultural anthropology to part-time DJ to massage therapist and how, and then, you know, there was the MLM in there, but, you know, we'll leave that piece out. How do you decide that design is the next route you're going to go?
Okay. Well, I had had, the opportunity to do some remodeling in my own home. Really, really enjoyed that. Did that when my kiddo was pretty little and I was doing massage really only kind of part-time then. As a kid, I had a drafting table. My dad's a contractor. My mom had an interior plant business. It just, you know, was sort of around me, design and space and construction. I felt really adept at the remodels that I did in my own home, and I really enjoyed it. Just design has always been a love of mine. And then just sort of bridging, you know, the concepts of health and wellness with space. There's so many cool modalities, if you will, around that now. So it felt like there was a way for me to, you know, not completely take off my healer hat, but do this other kind of work that can help people feel better.
It's interesting. I didn't know this was a thing. Is this a thing or is this just...
You didn't know what was a thing.
Yeah, so I'll toss a couple words out. There is a thing called biophilic design, which is about, you know, creating spaces that have these very kind of specific interventions or design approaches that connect people with nature. Mm-hmm. It's a scientific approach and it's being studied for things like reducing hospital stays, increasing employee productivity and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Right. So They're studying it in different ways. And people typically think of that as adding like interior plants to your space, but it is way more than that. Mm-hmm. Although plants are great, it's there's much more to it, including light and water and all these other variables. So lots of different ways that designers can create a connection to nature within spaces that then produce better outcomes. So within the treatment room, for example, then we think about that as a way to support the work that you're doing to help your clients get better results.
Interesting.
And then there's another body of work called neuroaesthetics, which is kind of looking more at how beauty affects well-being. So those are kind of two of the main ones. Then there's things like feng shui or vastu shastra that are, you know, more culturally specific.
Right.
So biophilic design kind of falls under the evidence-based design umbrella.
When you were a massage therapist, did you put a lot of thought and effort into your treatment room design?
Not particularly, although my approach to design typically is more on the minimal side. So I like things to be kind of clean and elegant and on the more minimal side. I just found this quote. It was a quote that said something like, a designer knows when they're done, when there's, you know, not another thing to add, but nothing left to take away. So it's about creating, you know, kind of an essential space. With, you know, not that maximalism isn't lovely if that's what you're into. The feedback I got about my treatment room was, and it was in my home for many years as well, was just, I would consistently get the feedback that people felt that it was calming. So I took note of that, you know, like, I just feel so calm when I walk into your space. So we, you know, we intuitively know that that how we put our spaces together affects us, mm-hmm. or that our the environment affects us. We don't need biophilic design like statistics to tell us that. It's intuitive, right?
Well, I asked that as well, because when I first became a therapist, you know, when massage therapy was my entire identity, it took me a little while to really even figure out like who I was as a therapist. And I remember the first place that I started working, it was a rental agreement. So I was given an empty, pretty ugly room.
Yeah, that room was pretty crappy.
it was a pretty crappy room.
Sorry if you're listening, clinic owner.
The person who who was renting that space before I was, she was actually moving out of the country. So she was willing to leave a lot of stuff behind. And it would not have been stuff I necessarily chose. Like, she left this desk that I thought was pretty hideous. The curtains were like, there's no other way to describe them. You know, the poop emoji, they were that color brown. and even like the artwork on the wall, like, anyway, it was nothing I would have chosen. But because I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I never really had felt, at least way back, I didn't feel like I ever really had an eye for design or anything. I was just like, okay, well, this is what the clients have been used to, because I'm taking over this practice, right? This is what they've been used to. It's not terrible. Like, there was like, it just didn't make any sense. Like, the artwork on the wall, I think there was like something that was beachy, but then, like I said, the poop brown curtains and the, I don't know, nothing makes
sense. Sounds like I put it together. Basically.
It was not great, but I just kind of left it. Like, I didn't really put any effort into it. I had a really thriving practice there. The clients were happy, but the room had nothing to do. Like, the room to me was honestly a little embarrassing. And then I got pregnant.
You know, I think that happens a lot in one way or another, where people just kind of like end up with the stuff that they have and don't overthink it, which is fine. But if we're actually intentional about creating the space, it can really like take some of the load off.
Yeah. And there was so many ways I could have improved it, but I didn't ever put any thought into it. And it is something you need to be intentional about. Mm-hmm. And when I got pregnant and had to find somebody to come cover my maternity leave, I bring in this therapist who is wildly different from me, like completely. Funny enough, she works with me again now. And when she came in, she said to me, "Do you mind if I like make some changes in this?" And I was like, "No, like have at it, go for it." Because at the end of the day, if I hated what she did, she could take it with her when she left. And it was as simple as she changed the poop brown curtains to something. I think they were like a shade of purple. Mm. She put in different lighting, like it was just a lot softer lighting. She put in a couple of little like she put in a shelving unit. So it just looked a lot more organized. She got rid of the hideous desk. And then on the shelving unit, she put a couple of like cute, I don't even remember what they were now, but like she put some like, I don't know if they were like figurines or statue or whatever, but all of a sudden I walk into the space after she has, you know, added a couple of things, like really didn't put a lot of effort into it. And I walked in and I was like, huh, I feel like I'm in a whole new place. Hmm. And it was just so much like, it
Did
didn't
you know
feel
that it was
so
possible?
I like
Did
the thing
you
is,
recognize
the that? Thing is I never put thought into it. And then once I saw what she had done, I was like, this is a place now I would feel much more relaxed. Like, I would want to spend time in here. Whereas, you know, the initial room, I was like, can I please get out? Mm. And I worked in that space lit with the poop brown curtains and the ugly desk and for like 5 years. And then she came in and just lightened up the whole space. And I was like, well, don't I feel dumb?
That's fabulous. That's really cool. I mean, and you got to kind of have that firsthand experience of the contrast of it. Mm-hmm. But also it sounds like, you know, it didn't take much to really shift the feel of the room.
It really didn't.
I would suck at creating a wellness space. Like, I've got two styles of which I do things. One is frat house. Hence this room. This room is a frat house.
But Jamie, this room is...
Because I spend all my time here.
This room is fantastic because everything you see here, if it was not in our office, would be in my living room. So
when I live by myself, this stuff was in my living room. Hence frat house.
Yeah.
I only got two ways of going things. Frat house or like... Hard Rock hotel room. Yes. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes. Those are the only two things that I think I can manage
but
to do.
But that's you, and that's where how you're comfortable. You're very comfortable in this room, and
yeah,
that's
so
cool.
I suck at making a wellness space, basically.
Wow.
But anyway, that's why
we have Jamie.
Why, exactly.
Yeah.
So when you went into design and, you know, decided this is the path you're going to take, do you remember, like, who was your first client?
Yeah,
who said, Jamie, make me a wellness space?
My first two clients were actually both in healthcare. The first was a PT clinic here in Portland. And for them, I pretty much just did a furniture plan. I did a little bit of a surface plan, but it was more in conjunction with their contractor and like the things they'd already picked out. So that was really fun and very exciting. And I wasn't quite set up yet to do business. I was still kind of floating my resume around and seeing if I could land in a firm somewhere. But that was a wonderful experience and learned a lot. And then my second decent sized project was an LMT who was just about to graduate. And then I think halfway through working together, she also started esthetician school. Mm-hmm. What I did for her was a design only plan, as opposed to a full scale design where I would be handling like everything. So for her, she had an existing like studio in her backyard that she was going to add onto. So we had an existing footprint that was pretty big. I can't remember the dimensions, but we divided it to create an entry area and a treatment room with some custom built-in cabinetry for storage and base cabinets with a sink. So she had a sink in her treatment room. And then we added on a bathroom. She also had been to interior design school, so it felt really cool that she trusted me with her project. And when I do a design only project, I'll specify everything. I'll select every single element that goes into the design and the finished product, but she was going to handle all the ordering. So she ended up completely, because she went to esthetician school, adding on another treatment room and sort of revising the floor plan a bit. Yeah, she's not quite done yet, so I haven't seen after photos.
I want to do a couple things. I want to play a game, but before you play the game...
Oh, no.
Yeah, no, the game is fine. But before you play the game, I want to know, in your mind, what's more important, overall function for the therapist or the psychology of the room for the client?
Oh.
I mean, both, although I do teach a massage room design class at Oregon School of Massage, and for the board of, you know, Oregon... Board of Massage Therapists, for them to be happy with the class, it had to really focus on the client.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, in terms of practitioner focus, I mean, I really feel like it's both, right? Like, you want the best ergonomics possible, the best function possible to make your life as a practitioner easier, which has a lot to do with space planning and ADA requirements.
Which ultimately helps the client as well.
Right.
I mean, if
but
they...
I, for sure. When I say that, I'm thinking about when I had a family doctor, his office was just all for him. Do you know what I mean? It had nothing to do with the psychology of the patient coming in.
Yeah.
It's just purely what he's got going on for him to function.
Are you talking about the doctor that I've been to as well? Or the...
I'm saying this is like every fucking family doctor I've ever had. And there's probably been three.
I was just thinking about your old family doctor that I took the kids to a couple of times.
Yeah.
And yeah, his office was like so cold and unwelcoming. And he sat so far away from you behind his desk with his laptop.
All right. You ready for the game? Are you ready for the game? I want to create a space that feels very medical in nature. Cool.
Medical.
I want to know colors. I want to know furniture. I want to know all that stuff. Give me some ideas. If I say, hey, I want this place to feel like it's really kind of medical massage based, that's the vibe I'm going for.
But can I say something before Jamie jumps in?
Sure.
I feel like she has already described this when she said minimalist and clean.
Yeah, but I also want to know colors.
All right, Jamie, tell us everything.
Of colors,
tell us everything.
And textures and all that stuff.
Well, you know, I think there is a bit of a like a bias or a preconceived notion or something that a clinical or a medical massage office should be a bit more sterile feeling. And I don't think that's necessarily true. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we would need to really focus on ADA compliance mm-hmm. In space planning and equipment selection. You know, white does kind of convey clean, but there are a lot of other neutral palette colors that you can work with that still kind of give it a more kind of clean look. So I think there's room for personality. I think there's room for preference when you're creating a clinical or medical space. So I don't think clinical or medical means a white sterile room.
No, man, hospitals are green.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot of room for preference, but you know, you might also be wanting to look at more like performance and contract grade, equipment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool. You rhyme off this type of space. What? I like this game. Yeah.
Well, okay. So before you,
just a couple more.
Before you went into the game,
yeah.
All I was thinking about is when you and I first started doing, you got to get treated here with massage therapy media and all of the cool treatment spaces we saw.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for example, let's say you wanted to create like what, because we've been to a place like this, let's say you wanted to create a space that felt like you were on vacation, like a spa that felt like you were leaving the city, but in the city. Mm-hmm. What kind of things would you think of to create something that felt like a getaway, but right in your city?
Yeah. I mean, I love that idea, you know, creating an oasis or mm-hmm. a sanctuary, a retreat. Like we need that more and more. You know, so if practitioners can kind of focus on making it feel more spa-like, I think that's can only help client retention and help your business and support your outcomes that you're looking for. Do you mean in terms of selections and colors and things like
that? Yeah, he wants to get some design ideas from you. Like if I said to you, I want you to create this like oasis in the city.
Because someone is listening right now. They're like, this sounds really cool. What would the expert suggest? What might be some ideas that someone that's an expert in this would shoot out without having a consultation with somebody, obviously?
Yeah. You know, this came up in a post recently. Somebody was talking about doing a wall mural or wallpaper. I think it's so underutilized and so has so much impact in a space if you can do wallpaper or a wall mural, something that kind of envelops the space, kind of gives it a big sense of cohesion and almost like a cozy or cave-like feel. Doesn't have to be dark, but you know, something that kind of unifies the walls, that's not just paint, that makes it really feel like a habitat or an environment in and of itself, not just like art on the walls.
Right. Yeah.
Like it's its own thing. So I think that can be really easily achieved and can be really fun to look at different wallpapers and wall coverings. That's one idea. I think really layering things like lighting and textiles gives it a really spa-like, you know, just really comfortable feel.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my students and clients even are still asking about kind of basic table setup and how to make it as comfortable as possible. So really focusing on just comfort. You know, and to me, having a, you know, treatment rooms are often really small.
Yes, that was going to be my question.
So like that room that you took over the practice for had a desk in it. We don't always have room for a desk.
Oh, wait. I should clarify. This was the tiniest little room. It was a desk that pulled down from the wall.
Like a Murphy bed?
Yeah. Okay. It was made of like metal.
Yeah. Like it was like a high school locker.
Yeah. Yes. It looked like a high school locker and it just pulled down from the wall. So if I had to write treatment notes in there, but I couldn't even keep the chair like in there.
So that was going to be my next part of the game. My next task there was I've got a small claustrophobic type of space. What can I do with this so it doesn't feel as small and claustrophobic?
Mm-hmm.
Edit. So just like take everything out that doesn't need to be in there. You know, you really only, if you're doing table work, I'm going to assume, you know, or, you know, pads, fine, whatever. You know, you can use that table to write your treatment notes.
Yeah.
Whether you're working on a computer, pen and paper. You know, often you can sit on the table, your client can sit on the stool. That's always an option. You know, get the clutter out, get any, just minimize it as much as possible. And then really mindfully and intentionally, you can start to layer things back in as space actually allows. I mean, I don't know how many times we have to see the Soji lamp that stands on the floor in a tiny room. That's fine. It gives off beautiful ambient light. But if there's really not space, we don't need a floor lamp. We need sconces.
What's a Soji lamp? Like, am I supposed to know this? Now I need to see.
Well, it's in 99.9% of treatment rooms. So I know you've seen it.
I'm Googling it right now. How do you spell Soji?
It's like, you know, that IKEA lamp that stands on the floor and it's like 4 feet tall and it's rice paper.
Girlfriend, I have it. It's in my room. It's in my treatment room. That's why I was like, wait a second. When you said that, I was like, I feel like this is probably the lamp I have in my treatment room. Let me, in my defense, the person who changed my treatment space from poop brown curtains to purple, she also put that lamp in there.
Yeah, it's not a bad lamp, but if we're talking small space, which most of them are, you know, look for suitable sconces or overhead or task lighting and, you know, get it layered, everything on a dimmer that's like the best thing you can do for your lighting if you can do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so funny. You know, and the salt lamp, right? Like everybody has the salt lamp.
Of course I do.
Yeah. It's great.
I love this conversation. I have like the most generic treatment room in the world. I have the salt lamp. I have now what I know is called the Soji lamp. I've got the like anatomy charts on the walls. Yeah, like I have a very generic treatment room. Maybe I should design it up. What do you think?
Can we talk about those posters for a hot second?
Okay. Am I going to get in trouble for the posters now?
You're not. No, I just, I wonder about them. And I wonder about them because do people use them because, and this is just a question, like this is just a conversation I have in the class that I teach and it's just a dialogue. But, you know, I feel like when I was in school, we were taught to display those as a form of credibility, that it gave us as practitioners a form of credibility. Mm. And some people do use them as reference, right? Like to point to different body parts or have their client engage
patient
with
education
the model.
Yep.
I don't know if I'd consider it art. You know, it's not art. I think it's a tool.
Yeah, it's definitely not art.
If we're talking about creating a room that's either, you know, maybe it has room in the clinical or medical massage room, but there's also like, you know, the laminated cards that we can hand our clients to talk about body parts and point to where things hurt or whatever. I gently challenge the anatomy poster.
Yeah. I've had the ones that are in there. I've had them forever. Like, I don't even, I mean, I think they might've been yours. I don't know.
Yeah. Cause I used to use them a lot for patient education.
I do actually still reference them for patient education. So I do use them, but again, the type of therapist I am, I mean, like I said, I didn't ever put much thought into what the space felt like or looked like. Mm-hmm. It's always been about function. And again, when we were doing the You Gotta Get Treated. So let me tell you about that, Jamie. I don't know. You may not have any idea. The other platform that we have, Massage Therapy Media, there's a reality channel. And Mark and I would go around to clinics pretty much just in southwestern Ontario. And we would have the clinic owner tour us around. And the intent behind this was actually for other therapists to get an exclusive look at what everybody else is doing.
Absolutely.
Because it's not something you get very often, right? So to look at why they made the choices they made in terms of what modalities they're going to use, how they set up their treatment space in terms of function, aesthetic. And so we got to see different designs of treatment spaces. So the one I mentioned where...
It was like MTV Cribs.
Yeah.
But for clinics.
So there was one place we went to that described her place as she wanted it to feel like you were going on a vacation in Toronto. Mm-hmm. So it was a spa in downtown Toronto. We went to one place, another clinic in downtown Toronto, where all of her treatment rooms were named after some kind of like precious stone, and the design all really fit around that that type of stone. You had mentioned the wallpaper. We went to a clinic somewhere in, you know, more Western Ontario, and it had different wallpaper in every room, and then the rest of the rest of the design was to kind of play off of whatever wallpaper design was in. So there was one that had like this big floral, I'm not making it sound, but it was really cool. It was these giant flowers on the wall, and that was like sort of the design of the whole room. Mm-hmm. Whereas then there was another room that was just a little more muted. I don't know. Anyway, it was really interesting to go to all of these different places and see like how the therapist managed to like tie the whole theme together. You know, we went to one place that she did a very like boho type of of theme. And there was, you know, there was greenery everywhere, and everything was really like neutrals. Mm-hmm. And she had like a whole tea selection. And anyway,
We were in Bayfield, she was in a Century Home.
Yeah, she was in a Century Home, and she kept a lot of the design was the first house in
Bayfield. Or something like that. Yeah,
and
yeah.
A lot of the design was based around keeping the heritage of the whole place. So it was really cool and comforting. We went to that one place in Markham that had like the room with like the fireplace and the haunted chair. Like there was a lot of really cool treatment spaces we saw.
That's great. That's so cool. I wish I could have done that with you all. What was your favorite one?
Oh, my favorite.
I don't know if I had a favorite one. There's definitely things that I can pick out about people's stuff. I was like, that was really cool. That was really cool.
Yeah.
But overall, I don't know if I had a favorite one.
What were some of the elements of how they put their spaces together that made an impression?
Okay. So for example, the one I was talking about, the space with the greenery, when you are the patient on the table. And again, this was just, she had an office space that had really high ceilings, and there were like ledges like around the top of the room. And then there was like windows above. I'm not doing a very good job explaining this, but she had plants like lining the ceiling of the room. So you might not even notice them when you first come in, but when you're laying on the table, it was like a jungle above you. And that was really cool.
That is really cool. And with those high windows, letting in maybe a little natural light.
Yeah, I really liked that. Of course, I loved Touch Massage Bar, the spa that we were talking about, that was like, you know, the oasis in the middle of the city. I really liked the design of her place. So it was very calming, like you're on vacation. And again, her rooms were themed after places that she had traveled to. So the one that sticks out to me, went into the Tulum room.
Yeah.
So it was like you were at a resort in Mexico getting a massage. It was really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love it.
You got to check out some of those. But yeah, I mean, we decided to do that so that therapists could get ideas. And this was well before we had any idea that you could actually hire a designer that knows the science behind creating a wellness space.
Yeah, it's a thing. I mean, I think it's maybe a little unusual for, you know, a solo practitioner to focus on that. Usually healthcare design is a little bit more institutional and bigger firms are working on those, but this is the lane I chose. So, you know, I think, you know, maybe it can be challenging for individual practitioners to want to invest a lot into their spaces. You know, once you're working, if you own a clinic, that's kind of a different level of investment, but you know, I think, like you said earlier, it doesn't take much to shift how a room feels and functions.
Yeah.
You know, and Mark, you had asked about color earlier.
Yeah.
I just wanted to touch on that briefly. You know, color psychology is a whole other body of work and study. And I think it's a little too subjective to sort of say, you know, these are the colors you should use, right? But I do think it's helpful for a practitioner to think about, you know, what colors are they using in their marketing and their branding, and, you know, maybe tie some cohesion together that way.
Also, color, for me at least, and I mean, I assume it's everybody, but I think maybe some people are more sensitive and notice these things. But for me, color actually does elicit certain like moods or feelings or what, I mean, even when I'm So I'm thinking back to like that ugly treatment space that I had. If I had put some effort and even just changing up the colors, like I said, the curtains or whatever, the artwork on the wall, there's certain colors that I think, because they change the way I'm feeling, it probably could have had a positive effect on how I was treating and how the patients were feeling instead of me looking at the shitty brown all day. But yeah, like colors have like a major effect. Like I know even when you're getting dressed, I don't know, Mark, you pretty much wear black every day. So maybe this doesn't apply to you.
I've got a uniform.
But there's certain colors that I'll put on and I instantly feel like this suits me or like this does not suit me. And I know like people can relate to that. Like there's certain colors I put on, I'm like, ooh, like this, no, this does not work for me. But then there's other colors I put on, I'm like, yep, yeah, absolutely. I don't even necessarily love the color red, but I actually look really good in the color red. So I should wear more red as I sit here in all black, just like Mark.
Yeah. I mean, you know, typical colors that get associated with more relaxing qualities are the blues and the greens or the neutrals. So those are kind of safe colors, I would say, to use in the treatment room. But you certainly don't need to be limited to those. You know, red is even a little bit on trend right now. I certainly wouldn't do like a bright cherry red, but you could do like an earthier, darker red that could feel really grounding, perhaps.
I definitely need someone like you. Like, I can go into a space and really enjoy a space, but I would never be able to come close to even being creative enough to create
them. You know that my best friend's first career was interior design, right? Yeah. And so she doesn't work in that field at all anymore. But if I'm ever struggling to figure, you know, Mark and I just moved, and so I'm in the process of setting up a whole new house and, you know, making rooms that function the way we want to and that look the way we want to and that feel the way we want to. And I'm actually having a lot of fun doing it. I'm doing it very slowly. Like I'm not in a rush to make everything perfect because I want it to be a certain way. But if I'm ever like struggling thinking like, what could I do here? I will literally sometimes just call her and say like, this is what I'm working with. This is what I want it to do. What do you got? And she always has really good ideas like right away. Like the design bone never left her, the design gene.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a blessing and a curse when you walk into a space and you just want to rearrange everything.
So give me an idea to the type of services that you provide to therapists.
Yeah.
Right. Does it range from, hey, just give me some ideas? What's the whole spectrum of what you're doing in terms of design there?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the kind of lowest entry point is I do have a free download on my website for treatment room design that folks can find on my services page and download that for free. So that's, you know, elaborating on these ideas and just giving some ideas about how to set up a room. I also do just a one-time consultation. That's 1 hour or more, just kind of as a one-time event. And we just go down your checklist, you know, answer questions, provide resources and, guidelines, depending on, you know, whatever challenges somebody's working with in their treatment room. And then it kind of goes up from there. So I'll do, furniture plans and finish plans. So that kind of falls under more renovation. So if we're not moving any structural walls, which would be remodeling, but if we're doing finishes, you know, countertops, cabinetry, walls, and then the furniture and any fixtures and equipment, including lighting. So that could be a full design plan. I offer that in a couple different ways. So I do design only, which is, you know, providing the complete design for somebody. Usually starts with, you know, a full intake process. And then we do a mood board that kind of guides the design development. And then at the end of that, you get the layout for everything and a spreadsheet with links so you can order yourself. And that usually works best for virtual clients. If in Portland, I can also do full service design, which is handling all of the ordering and receiving the installation too. So sort of these tiered ways to work together.
Have you ever had a client that just says, hey, do whatever you want? I have zero to input.
Because that would be you.
Because that would be me. I have zero to input. Or do you reject a client like that?
I don't know that I'd have to have a bigger conversation, I think, with the person to find out what that really means, like where are the boundaries around do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. But in terms of having free reign with the design, I still want to get client input about their preferences so I can start to shape it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I can put something together just based on what I think would work well in the space, in the context, in the environment that it's in. You know, I like to take cues from, you know, the local space, the local environment and community, kind of maybe tying in a little bit of that cultural anthropology, like who is this person and where do they live and what influences them? What is their practice about, right? Like what kind of practice do they have? Is it medical or relaxation or a little bit of both, right? So, I'm definitely taking influences into that. I wouldn't just make it like what I like.
Have you ever had this scenario where you have a client that hires you to do this and is giving so much resistance? And if so, how do you handle something like that?
I guess I've been lucky enough not to have a quote unquote difficult client yet. I would like to think that my skills as a practitioner in the past are going to guide me well along this path as a designer, and that I'll be able to work with, you know, challenges and pushback. You know, I feel like there's always a way to collaborate and find a solution that works for the client. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the ugliest treatment room you've ever seen.
Oh, girl, please. I mean, for the class that I put together for Oregon School of Massage, I did such a deep dive. I mean, just Google massage room or treatment room or, you know, massage therapy room, and you will see a lot of ugly treatment rooms. I don't know. I mean, I think it's just, Amanda, no offense, but like the ones that feel like a total afterthought.
Yeah.
You know, like just haven't actually thought about it. You know, and maybe there are some things that are working and feel successful about the way the room is put together. And then maybe there are a bunch of things that don't. And it just feels a little bit like a hodgepodge or like, oh, they had that thing at home, so they just brought it to their treatment room, but it doesn't really function. And maybe it's just taking up space. And what is it communicating to the client? And, you know,
there's one treatment room that's coming to mind right now. That was worse than mine. Mm-hmm. I don't want to call out the person specifically in case they listen, but no, I can't do it because I like the therapist. I really do. But I walked into this treatment room and got instant anxiety with the amount of clutter. As ugly as my treatment room was, as much of an afterthought as it was, it was never cluttered. And this person's treatment room just had shit everywhere. Mm. Like it was so messy. I don't even know how to describe, like there was shelves with stuff everywhere. And, you know, they had like all the different tools, but nothing was organized or put in a way that to me made, anyway.
Was that consistent with the person?
It was chaos. The person's a little chaotic.
Yeah.
It was off mic. I can tell, you know, the person, but anyway, I was like, I would not want to be a client in this treatment room. I actually got that feeling going in there. Like this is too chaotic for me. So that was the ugliest treatment room I've ever seen.
That's such a good point. I mean, I think keeping things organized and presentable, you know, and concealed, right? Like as much as possible, you can use, case goods, storage, you can hide stuff in. So if you're not like the neatest person, at least you can hide it.
Yeah, seriously. At this point, like they may have been better off like throwing a sheet over the whole the shelf.
Is that a consistent thing though? Like frumpy people have frumpy rooms? Like
frumpy people? No.
Do you see what I'm saying? Like I'm just curious.
The reason I'm saying no is like I think that some people can be maybe messy in their home life, but you know, like so they're different at
someone
work.
Someone that their personal appearance looks like it's an afterthought. Is there a correlation between that person and then their treatment room that they put together themselves?
I mean, you can ask Jamie. I don't necessarily think so. And I'm only going based on certain people that I know that I think fit into this description where like I know that their home isn't necessarily the most organized, themselves, like, you know, they're the person with the messy car that doesn't have like their hair done or whatever, you know, like a little bit disheveled, but then their treatment space, they put more effort into because they're client focused. It's like, I want to make sure that my clients feel relaxed. So they'll put the effort there, but the effort isn't necessarily going into their personal appearance. I mean, they're still clean because I mean, otherwise, if you're not at least hygienic, don't be a massage therapist, please. Like, please don't. But I do know this person who's like a little disheveled in their personal life, but their treatment space is very well put together. But there's obviously an intent there. Like, this is my job and I'm going to do my job really well.
Well, that's great. At least they didn't let it spill over into their workspace.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's such a good point is just, you know, and I think there's, this is more kind of in the professional organizing realm. You know, there's a lot of, you know, like the Marie Kondo show and all those shows that talk about, you know, how organizing your space and getting rid of stuff you don't use and all of that can really shift how you function and how mm-hmm. you feel in your space. So
it's my favorite thing to do. Marie Kondo is my hero. I love getting rid of things. I love it. It's my favorite thing to do. I'm like, where is the closest donation center? I want to get rid of everything.
Yeah, I've done that a little too much in the past, actually. But
I know I might have a problem. I don't know why getting rid of things brings me so much joy.
Well, you make room for the new stuff, right?
It's got to be it. Out with the old, in with the new. Blessings, of course, not stuff. I'm not materialistic. What I do want, though, is for anybody that is listening, Jamie, can you give out some details, your website, if you're on social platforms, how can people find you and see your work and possibly get in touch?
Sure. My website is Happy House Studios, and that's HAUS because I'm fancy like that, I guess. HappyHouseStudios.com, and then I'm on Instagram as well at happy and then underscore HAUS underscore studios, plural. Yeah, so I'm primarily on Instagram as far as socials go. I have a Pinterest as well. I've got like a little board for massage room essentials up there. I just made that happen. Out. Kind of proud of myself for figuring that out. I'm not the most tech savvy person. I've learned a lot since going to design school about technology, you know, coming from a body centered world to a computer centered world has been an interesting transition. So that's how folks can find me.
Awesome.
I want to do one more thing.
Yeah. You want to play another game?
Well, not really, but well, sort of, yes, sort of, no. I would love to kind of in closing, give us maybe three do's and three don'ts.
Okay. I know you probably want these to be practical, but I do want to say, you know, first be intentional, right? So I guess I'll make that number one. Mm-hmm. Be intentional, you know, spend some time really thinking about like, what is the, how do you want your clients to feel walking into your space and how can you start to build your space around that intention? You know, thinking about your branding and your colors and all of that can be part of it too. Number two, I would say whenever possible, choose quote unquote healthy materials. That kind of goes hand in hand with biophilic design, but you know, the idea of choosing sustainable products, is another way to support your health as a practitioner, but your clients' well-being. So things that are going to reduce indoor air pollution, you know, these are rooms that we're enclosed in a lot of the time. So choosing materials that are not going to off-gas, choosing low VOC paints and materials, buying secondhand is always great, that sort of thing, right? There's a lot more to that, but kind of being mindful about the material element itself and how that can either support health or not. Mm-hmm. Is something I like to focus on. And, you know, we can't always be 100% healthy or sustainable in our choices. And that's not really the goal, but you can focus, you know, focus it around a health goal, like choosing, you know, non-carcinogenic materials as a focus, for example.
Right.
You know, so you're not trying to hit every single check mark necessarily, but focus on what it is that you want to have as a health goal of your space. This didn't come up, but I'm just going to toss it in randomly here. A water feature is a really like powerful biophilic element. The presence of water, it could even be artwork of water. We, you know, I think, again, most people kind of think of biophilia as plants, but water is a really powerful element. So people can maybe bring a water feature in, which also gives a little bit of noise, distraction, dampening quality. Certainly not going to solve all the sound issues. That's a whole other topic, soundproofing, which is, you know, something that we can do.
Now three don'ts. What should we not do?
Oh yeah, that was my third one. Great. We should not clutter the space.
Yay.
Yay.
Cluttered space, cluttered mind, guys.
We should not use floor lamps if we don't have to. I think, you know, just as a practical thing, like they're probably in the way and we can probably do sconces or task lighting or dimmers overhead or something else. I think floor lamps can be tricky, just like extra, you know, material. I think my two is kind of running into my number one here a little bit, but editing down your space, is really helpful. Third, maybe don't use like a portable massage table. Invest in an electric table because you're going to get a tax credit. And I don't know if this is true in Canada. I'm sorry, but in the US we get a tax credit for investing in ADA compliant equipment. But I think, you know, not using a standard kind of portable table and upgrading to an electric table is a game changer for the practitioner and the client.
I like it. Ah, well, you're not near your mic, so I'm just speaking for you. He likes it too. This was actually very interesting. It was funny when Jamie first sent the email, I said to Mark, hey, there's a ex-LMT in the States that designs treatment rooms. What do you think? Should we have a pot? And he's like, yeah, sure. And I was like thinking to myself, how much are we going to be able to talk about design? I feel like we could continue talking, but, you know, we all have regular lives to go back to. But this was a lot more educational than I even expected it to be.
Oh, awesome. I'm so glad. I mean, I'm glad you enjoyed it, got something out of it. Awesome. Fun games. Thanks, Mark.
Well, I'm definitely going to go check out your Pinterest board now, yes, and see how we can level up my very generic treatment room with the exact lamps that you listed off that everybody has. This was the best day. The good news is my treatment room is enormous, so the floor lamp is not getting in the way. So that's nice.
Totally. Right? It's like if you actually have the space for it, go for it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for hanging out with us, Jamie. This was super fun.
Thanks for having me. Great conversation. Appreciate it.
Right on. You guys have been listening to Two Massage Therapists in a Microphone. Peace.